Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is someone you already love. It's Meredith May, who is a wonderful writer. You can scroll back and listen to her other ones. But today she is here to talk about a new book of hers called I Who Did Not Die. And it's a little bit complicated because Meredith wrote it at the motivation of another writer. Isn't that correct? You tell about it and what it is.
Yeah, well, the reason the love letter I have in mind right now is to another San Francisco writer who, without him putting in a kind word for me to his agent, I'm not sure this book would have ever happened. And, you know, there are always these people who, other artists who do so much for other artists behind the scenes, and you never find out about it. And then there are other artists who promote only thyself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. For fear of competition, I would guess.
Well, it's just so hard. It's so hard to get traction, you know? So you do have to spend so much time promoting your own work. I completely understand it. But this writer said to me when I first met him, the job of an artist is 50% your own work and 50% bringing up the tribe.
Oh, how lovely.
And I never forgot that. So his name is Joshua Moore. And I'm sure a lot of people listening know him. He used to teach at USF, and he has written 5 novels, all set in San Francisco, and they usually feature these. They're usually set in the Mission. They feature the hard knocks, drunks in the bars. It's like the gritty underbelly of San Francisco, like pre-tech revolution, really. And then he finally wrote his own memoir, which is the book that's out now called Sirens. And really, I think he was just writing his own story over and over and over.
Oh, so his book, this book that you brought with you, isn't the same topic as yours?
Correct.
Oh,
I just brought it so I would say his name correctly
and
not goof up.
And he deserves credit for that generosity. My goodness.
But the way it happened is I interviewed him when I was a writer at the Chronicle. About one of his books, and I remember we hit it off really well. We met in a cafe in the Mission, and we talked a lot about art, and he made me feel really comfortable, and at the time I was working on a manuscript about my beekeeping childhood, and he asked me a lot of questions about it, and he said, well, you know, when it's ready, I'll read it for you, or I'll, you know, and I thought that was nice, you know. And then like a year went by, and then he called me at work when I was still at the Chronicle, and he said, hey, where's that manuscript? And it was written, but I was I freaked out. I didn't know what to do with it. And he said, well, would you like me to tell my agent about you? And he did. And his agent took a look at it, and his agent said, I like it, but it's not really my style. Mm-hmm. His agent's like a drummer in a punk band, and more of a dude. I guess my book was more of a girl. I don't know. But he passed my manuscript to a colleague, Heather Karpis, and this is at ICM in New York. And she hadn't yet sold a book. She was a new up-and-coming agent. And she called me one day and said, I love it. And I did what you're supposed to do, which is say, well, what have you published? And who are you? And she said, well, nothing yet. And I just loved her.
Perfect.
And I said, I haven't written anything yet. Let's do this. And now she's sold over a dozen books. She's doing really well.
Oh, and I'm glad to hear that.
So, and she helped me get my first book out, which is not the beekeeping one.
Okay. Talk about, so it's this one.
Yeah. Yeah. This one's called I Who Did Not Die. It's a true story. It's about two soldiers on opposite sides of the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. One was a child, the Iranian, and they were.
When you say on opposite sides, you're saying raised to be foes, right? Is that what
they?
You're...
Yeah, they were both in the military. They were at the same battle, and the Iranian had orders to kill the Iraqi. He found the Iraqi wounded, and he was supposed to shoot him, but he secretly nursed him back to health instead. He risked his life to save a stranger, and then 20 years later, they accidentally sit down next to each other in a help center for torture survivors in Vancouver. And
they had not been in touch with each other over this 20...
They only met 3 days on the battlefield. Okay. That's it. Then they went their separate ways. They both got captured, imprisoned, tortured. 20 years later, they wound up sitting next to each other in another country.
So you're going to tell us about that particular meeting?
Sure.
Would you?
You want to hear about it?
Yes, of course I do.
Najah is the Iraqi. He was imprisoned for 17 years. And when he finally gets out and goes home, his family home is gone. A lot of his relatives are dead. He returns to Basra, and it's just decimated. He gets to Vancouver using one of his brother's passports. Mm-hmm. This is pre-9/11. So that's why he's in Vancouver. The other man, Zahed, is working. He returns to Iran. He has a very hard time, PTSD, can't keep a job, keeps getting thrown in jail. And he finally decides nobody else on land will hire him. So he gets a job on a merchant ship and sails around the world. And the ship docks in Vancouver. And he has a fight on board with the captain. And so they say, well, great. As soon as you get back,
to
Iran. Yeah. Religious ideology. Zahed was very anti-religion. Mm-hmm. After all he'd been through in the war, mm-hmm. and seen all the destruction and the violence that comes from purported religion.
I'm glad you said it that way. Because, you know,
religion, can be great.
Right. I heard somebody said, and I think it's a well-known thing, that it makes good people better and bad people worse.
Exactly.
And, you know, I have run into people who say, oh, you know, it's just all the fault of religion. Or, mm-mm. No, it's the fault of the people who use it as the ammo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm glad you
mm-hmm.
said that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, writing this book has made me a much more spiritual person because the chances of them meeting again are beyond infinitesimal, right?
Yes.
So there is something out there that's looking out for us, and you can call it God or you can call it Mother Nature, the universe, dumb luck, karma. But that's why we have so many terms for something that's undescribable. There's something there. And you were asking me, about them meeting. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
And did they recognize each other
No, they didn't. They didn't. They just started talking. But the Iranian, Zahed, he got in this fight, and he didn't want to go back to Iran because they were going to throw him in jail for punching the captain. And he didn't want to go to jail again after being prisoner of war. He just couldn't do it. So he jumps overboard into the English Bay in Vancouver, is rescued by a kayaker, homeless for a couple of weeks. Anyway, he eventually gets some help from the Canadian government or some refugee assistance. But he's really having a hard time, and he decides to take his life. So he waits till his two roommates leave, and he tries to hang himself. One of the roommates forgets his sunglasses.
Oh,
he comes
gosh.
Back for his Ray-Bans. He loved these Ray-Bans so much he would sleep with them. Comes back and he sees Zahed hanging and he cuts him down.
Hmm.
So the ER doctor would not release Zahed until Zahed promised to go to this help center for torture survivors. So that's the backstory. When Zahed walks into the lobby, sits down next to this other guy, they start talking. And Zahed says, hey, are you Persian? Because he has a Persian accent, even though he's Arabic. He's no, no. And they're talking back and forth, and Najah doesn't want to talk to this guy. But eventually they find out they're both POWs. They're in the same war. What battle were you in? What day? Do you remember being in a bunker? Do you remember? And then they start screaming. Their voices are raising and raising and raising. And then they realize that's you. You know, one says, I was saved by a little boy. That's all I remember is a little boy because he was 13. And Zahed is saying, that was me. I saved you. So what was so amazing is now the Iraqi got a second chance to thank the Iranian and save him. It flip-flopped because it was... Zahed had just tried to hang himself. He saw no reason to live, but now instantly he had a reason. So the other guy got to save the kid this time.
My goodness. I'm just kind of speechless. You must have been too listening to this.
Yeah. I mean, the first question everyone asks me is this true? I mean, it seems too perfect.
But, you know, I think they're historically, and I think if we think about it, we've all known some, where there have been rescues. And 20, you know, I wonder about that. 20 years will elapse, and why didn't you look for the person who saved your life?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that's about? I mean, I think it was just so painful that you need to wipe it out of your...
Yes, and I also think...
I mean, look how long it took, like, for Schindler.
Right.
For those families to find him, or, you know, well, it doesn't even matter. I mean, there are lots of instances where lives have been saved, and then you go about your new life somehow, and you don't look back.
Also, so many people died. I Najah assumed that this kid was dead. It was one of the bloodiest wars, conventional wars of the 20th century, and there were like 700,000 people died. Mm-hmm. So many people died that I am sure, I know each man thought the other was dead. There was no point to even, and they didn't know each other's names.
Right.
So they didn't know where to begin to look for each other. Well, even if they had assumed that they were alive.
I mean, there are many reasons for not, but there's always a place to start. Mm. But anyway, okay, so good for this. Why don't you read us some of these?
Okay.
If you would.
Sure.
I think we'll get a better idea.
Yeah, I can read you first from Zahed's point of view when they met on the battlefield, and then I can flip it and read the Najah's point of view.
Let's do it.
Because the book is written in alternating chapters from the points of view of the different men. Okay. Okay, so this is the child.
Just curious about one thing. Do they have families now?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Zahed married and has two children, daughter, an older daughter, and an 11-year-old boy. And Najah is reunited with a brother and sister in Vancouver.
Wonderful. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So this I'm going to read to you is when 13-year-old Zahed is searching the bunkers, underground bunkers on the battlefield, with orders to shoot any Iraqi still alive. He turned his head and looked directly at me and said something I didn't understand in Arabic, but I think I caught one word of it. Muslim. It came out like Muzim. I stood and put my finger on the trigger, but my shaking hands made it impossible to fix on a point.
Was he saying that so that the kid would realize they share something?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. He was begging for his life. Then he lifted his hand and weakly reached for his shirt pocket. This Arab was going to blow us both up. I dove to reach the grenade first, but my fingers touched paper instead, and I pulled out a pocket-sized Quran. I slumped to the ground, now the one gasping with relief. Every Basij I knew carried a Quran into battle for protection.
Basij is the Iranian child soldiers.
And I guess all the Iraqis did, too. I looked back at the wounded man to make sure he wasn't reaching for anything else. Muslim, Muslim, he moaned. There was something hidden in the book. I suspected money after watching the other soldiers pillage so many dead bodies. I'd learned that the Quran everyone carried doubled as a wallet. I held it open on my palm and the pages fluttered back to reveal a photograph tucked inside. I saw a woman with olive skin and dramatic eyebrows holding an infant to her chest. The baby's face was in profile, but it was so young that its skin was still bright red. The woman's dark eyes cast a spell, like she could look straight into my secrets. There was something about her gaze, a sadness that made me want to hold her hand and tell her everything was going to be okay. I knew I was holding his family in my hands. These were the people who loved him, who would die inside if I killed him. She was so beautiful, the kind of wife I would want someday, and would be wrong to ruin her life, and even more evil to take away a baby's father. This soldier had a life that wasn't here, that wasn't supposed to end with me shooting him in a bunker. Something had brought him to this war that was out of his control, because why else would he leave such a beautiful family behind? The Iraqi smiled weakly at me, and that's when I noticed that we were the same.
We both had two eyes, a nose, and a mouth. Why was I supposed to hate him? He had never harmed me. I'd managed to get this far in the war without killing anyone, and I wasn't going to start now. If I put a bullet in his temple to end his misery, then the guilt would haunt me forever. I could walk away, but letting him suffer was more inhumane than taking his life. Or I could be merciful.
Other side?
Okay.
You do have to wonder, at least I wonder.
Yeah.
About a 13-year-old. Well, there's no reason a 13-year-old shouldn't be so developed an adult to realize these things. But it's not so common.
He is a really interesting character.
He follows his own mind, and he ran away from home to join the military.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, he is pretty advanced. Okay, let me
see. So he ran away from home to join the military, but then found himself in an untenable position of what the military wanted him to do.
Right. He thought it was like going to be like John Wayne.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kids see those marching off to war flags and,
and
uniforms.
He had a violent father, too, so he was running from a violent home.
Okay. So that's what was going on. Okay, so this is the same scene from the point of view of the wounded Iraqi soldier.
Okay.
It felt like my intestines had turned to lava and they were slowly melting me from the inside. I had the sensation that the heat was retreating from my extremities, pulled inward into a molten ball in my stomach, as if the last of my energy was swallowing itself until it would be no more than a tiny pinprick, then blink out forever. It's true what they say about your whole life flashing by as you wait for death to come sit next to you. It happens fast, like Kodachrome slides snapping into view, all these images of yourself in moments of pure joy. I closed my eyes and saw my brothers and me climbing trees to pick dates. I felt my fingers close around the fur of our big German shepherd as we wrestled in the family courtyard, and heard my mother's voice singing from the kitchen. I tasted the falafel that my sister and I fried in our Bruce Lee restaurant, and I saw Aaliyah's abaya fluttering in the wind as she cradled Amjad in her arms. The last thing I saw was my family together, celebrating the 30th birthday I would never have. Then I felt a hand on my chest. I opened my eyes, but I was momentarily blinded. When I tried to reach for that hand, my limbs were numb and wouldn't move. It's an angel, I thought, tugging on my shirt to take me to the other world. And, like all non-believers who face their moment of death, I found religion instantly. Dear Prophet Muhammad, I prayed aloud, save me. My vision cleared and I saw a child soldier pointing a rifle at my temple. He was so small that he had to roll up the sleeves and pant legs of his uniform. This Persian boy had been brainwashed to hate me. I spoke as softly as I could. Please, I said, I'm a Muslim, just like you. He backed up a step and cocked the rifle. He either couldn't understand Arabic or he didn't care to chat before pulling the trigger. Muslim, Muslim, I pleaded. The boy took aim. Carefully, I reached into my jacket pocket to show him my Quran, and the boy lunged, grabbing it from me. He rustled through the pages, stopping when he discovered the photo of Aaliyah and Amjad. He studied the image as if he recognized them. He glanced at me and back to the photo again. I think I saw him gently touch her face with his finger. He snapped the book shut and turned toward me with an expression of utter blankness. I silently said goodbye to everyone I loved. Then the boy slid the Quran back in my pocket. He knelt down and gave me water from his canteen. Then he leaned in close and put his finger to his lips. Shh.
All right, so now, I mean, I do need to know what was the next step for these two. How did he nurse them back to health?
Zahed, the child soldier, was actually a medic. That was his job.
Oh, my goodness.
So he
Another piece of dumb luck.
Yeah, he ran back to the field hospital, and he would get morphine and water and IV bags of blood, and he would
bring him back, and he jammed a bayonet into the wall to hold up the IV, and so he gave Najah medicine that way. He had hidden him. There were dead bodies in this bunker, and
Zahed, some kind of an enclosure.
They were underground in a bunker, yeah. And Zahed piled up the dead bodies against a corner and hid Najah behind it, so that because soldiers were coming by, poking their heads into bunkers, shooting people, and going to the next bunker. So he was hidden behind other dead bodies.
I like the way you say that, because you touched on something important. You said soldiers go into the bunker and just started shooting people.
Mm-hmm.
And then go into the next bunker, and you're not identifying who's doing the shooting.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. The horror of it is that it doesn't matter.
This is a place called Khorram Shahr, and it is in Iran, and it's the first city that fell to the Iraqis, and the Iraqis had it for almost 2 years. And this battle where the two men met was when the Iranians took it back. So the Iranians were shooting all the Iraqis after the battle who were wounded and not yet dead.
What is the hope for this? What is the hope for an end to war?
Oh, my God.
Just thought I'd mention. Well, because, you know, at some point I was reading a lot of evolutionary biology, and it turns out that a shocking percentage of mankind has been at war, killing each other forever. We don't know about them all.
Yeah.
There was a time that we didn't know what went on beyond our shores. Communication wasn't what it was today.
I think we have to, this is a huge question, but we have to bite off pieces of it. And wars continue because they continue in the abstract, right? We're so far away from their conceptual. They're like sporting events. Well, did we regain how much territory? Mm-hmm. What's our soldier count?
Yes, in the abstract, you know, they talk about, I know every time our president from before would talk about how many boots on the ground, we're going to send in boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't boots on the ground. Those are somebody's sons and daughters.
Right. And, you know, especially right now, when, you know, we have a president who is demonizing certain people from certain countries, the only way to counteract that is to humanize people from certain countries and show that, you know, Iraqi, Iranian, Canadian, Californian, we're all the same. And that's what I think is so lovely about this story. It's a man bites dog story, right? Here you have two people who are encouraged, allowed, and applauded for killing each other. And in fact, they're in danger if they don't.
Right.
And they still don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather risk their own lives. Because if the boy had been caught doing this, they would have just killed him on the spot instantly.
Now, how did they each end up in a prisoner of war camp? What was the next thing? Because apparently they suffered anyway.
Yes. Eventually, after 3 days, the call came down from command that stop killing wounded Iraqis and get them to a field hospital. So Zahed was allowed to put Najah on a stretcher.
Why did that change?
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know.
Okay.
Whoever was left who was wounded, they were all sent to a hospital, but they went, as soon as they recuperated, all those patients went straight to prisoner of war camps. So actually,
where they were tortured.
Yeah. So actually, I probably do know the answer to your question.
I like it, because it doesn't make any sense. Why make them better and then send them to the hospital? Prisoner of war camps to be tortured. Why not just kill them right away?
Right. I think one strategy was to collect prisoners and then you use them as bargaining chips to try to get what you want from the other country.
Sure. We'll release
if you do this. So that was also part of the strategy.
And the torturing of them was just for the joy of it? Like, what was that for?
No. Well, I'm sure that was a part of it.
Because you saw that a lot in the Japanese prisoner of war camps.
Well, there was a lot of indoctrination happening. So, for example, the Iraqis that were held by the Iranians were forced to pray, you know, and vice versa. If,
excuse me, you were like, for example, you were forced to chant "Long live Khomeini" if you were an Iraqi.
Oh, so specific.
Yeah, and if you were held by Iraq and you were Iranian, you were forced to learn the Quran and. Excuse me, you were forced to chant for Saddam. Mm. You know, so there was a lot of indoctrination happening on both sides. So that was part of it. And if you were like Najah in my book, if you were a prisoner who refused to switch sides or didn't want to pray, they kept transferring you to more brutal prisons. You know, they called you a hardliner and they would... Okay, well, if you refuse to pray, you refuse to pray to our leader or support our leader, okay, we're going to put you in a place where it's a cave in a rock and there are no windows and it's dark all day. And it just kept getting worse. He went to 5 or 6 different prisons, but he refused to switch his country's allegiance.
I think the only way we can learn about the horror of this is not when we see the overall picture. To say that 700,000 people were killed... doesn't really, that's so hard to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
That's another, what did you call it before, you know, kind of...
abstraction.
A total abstraction.
Right.
It's
right.
A number.
Right.
But when you look at these two, oh, you've done a good thing here.
And I also want to say...
this is also made for a movie.
Reach
others.
There are moments of humor in here, too. There's a love story. There's, a refugee story. You know... when I set about doing this project, I thought, wow, this is going to all be guns, killing, war, and then prison. It's going to be a really heavy book. But I was really delighted to hear stories about their ingenuity, how to get their lives started again. There's this beautiful love story with Najah and the mother of his child, the one that's in the photo, how they flirt in the bread line in the morning. There's a separate bread line for men and women.
That's if I may just say,
yeah.
I've known your writing since you were at the Chronicle doing what they call human interest stories,
yeah.
Right? Which is your ability to eke out the full truth of a life.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a life where if you look at it properly, there is not humor and love and lighter moments, which, by the way, makes the tragedy more horrible.
And you have to have that. I mean, if you figure 17 years in prison, how do you get by? And Najah was a wonderful storyteller, and he was really enamored of Bruce Lee. So as part of my research, I watched a lot of Bruce Lee movies, and I guess Bruce Lee only made 5 before he died young.
Yeah, that's awful.
So Najah had them all memorized, so he would reenact them for the prisoners, and he would do it like a soap opera over weeks and months and draw it out and add to the storylines and twist them up. And then the prisoners got really interested in kung fu. So Najah started giving kung fu lessons on the yard. And
they allowed that?
Yeah, some of the 5 different prisons he was in were all different. Okay. Some were more lax and open to the outdoors and let you go in between rooms. On the worst end of the spectrum was this prison called Sang Bast, cut into a cave, where they fed them they dropped a basket through a hole in the ceiling, and they made them chant to Khomeini for the food. And if they weren't chanting vigorously enough, they yanked the basket back up. And, there was never enough food to go around. They were all very skinny, and a lot of them died of hunger. So,
terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. So the name of this book, again, is I Who Did Not Die, and it's orderable.
Yeah, it's all the usual places. It's actually officially out today.
Yes,
so,
I did that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I didn't know there's a thing among writers where you say happy pub day to each other.
I've had a pub day to you.
A few calls from writers.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's on the Reagan Arts is the publisher. It's on their website. They sell their own books. It's also on Amazon. Locally, I know for sure it's in City Lights, Book Passage, in Marin.
Places. Easy to ask for.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for doing this. Before I let you go, just talk about the letter that you want to write.
Josh. I want to write to Josh. I've done this in little...
We're going to change that to I will write to Josh, right?
Yeah, I will write to... Thank you.
I've sent him little quick thank yous in a book and so
good,
forth.
Okay.
But I will write to him and just tell him how important that one phone call he made to me saying, hey, where's your manuscript? Is it ready yet? And just that little push and that little belief from a writer who had already published books. And he was just checking in on me without any need to or not. I don't know. I want to be able to pay that forward.
Yes, this speaks so well for him. And I have something to say before I really tell you goodbye here. I never like telling you goodbye.
Yeah.
That you touched on something in the story that you wrote about these two men and what this writer did for you, what Josh Moore did for you, which was strengthening.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who know how to strengthen others. This man's doing the Bruce Lee plays,
right?
Movies.
Mm-hmm.
In the prisoner of war camp was some kind of an innate knowledge of how to strengthen others.
Exactly.
And teaching them the art of self-defense following that.
Mm-hmm.
And this author calling you, strengthening you.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't much more than that at that time.
Right.
Was it?
Just that little flicker of belief.
Yes.
Is all it takes. And you know, sometimes we don't realize how much we can do for someone else just by telling them to keep going.
Yes, and two things. That's what love letters are about. Let me just put that plug in for writing it down and mailing it. But also, it is so much easier to help people than to hinder them.
Right.
I want to end on that.
And
why
yeah.
not? Go ahead and what?
And why, exactly. And so why don't more people do it?
I don't know. I mean, you can see how hard it is to hinder people. You have to go to war.
Right, right.
And it makes you feel awful.
Yeah.
Helping people is so easy and makes everybody feel good forever. Oh, thank you for doing this with me, dear. I'm looking forward to getting your book and reading the whole thing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Until next time, this is Janet Gallen and Meredith May saying goodbye. I hope you come back and
hope you feel better.
Do something else with it. Thank you.